that favouring a narrative. On the great side, I'd like him to undertake the effective task of restoring confidence.
Thank you, President. Thank you, Christina and Sarah. I'm going to address you from the perspective of a mediation practitioner. What is the purpose of mediation? Mediation is fundamentally about helping couples navigate and make informed decisions in the context of separation and divorce. So mediation is really about managing transitions. So what are the transitions that couples and families are going through? Well, we have the psychological process, the legal process, and the familial process. By psychological process, I mean our human need to make sense of our situation, which when separating is often compounded by disharmonious thoughts and feelings and competing voices in our heads. Dealing with the loss of your most important relationship, dealing with the pain, guilt, deception, this person that you would have trusted more than anyone, and now you feel you no longer know. The well-known bereavement cycle of denial, anger, bargaining, depression, before finding acceptance, is often a raw and confusing experience which can last for many years. Then there's the legal process. If you're not married, and that's now the majority of couples having children, you might find there's no such thing as a common law wife and that you have no rights to the house that you've been living in for many years. You might find as a father that you don't have parental responsibility for the 12-year-old son you've lived with all your life. What about those going through the formal procedures of divorce or dissolution of their civil partnership? The legal process often takes months or years, can cost enormous sums of money, and if your relationship as parents was strained when you started litigating, it's highly unlikely to improve as a result of it. And then there's the familial process. Children will assume that nothing changes. The parents will always be together, and they will always live in the same home. Meanwhile, parents will be detaching from one another emotionally, no longer accountable to one another, yet their ability to collaborate as separated parents is essential in helping their children through this difficult transition. When we think about the practical arrangements for children, where everyone will live, how the finances are going to work, I'll often talk to clients about how much they want to subcontract their decision-making to other people. We can construe this as a continuum, with DIY at one end of the continuum and litigation leading to adjudication by the court at the other. Where do they want to be? Mediation, then, is the first step along this continuum. Not their kitchen table, but my mediation table. I manage the process, but they will still be making the decisions. Other points along the continuum would encompass collaborative law, lawyer negotiations, private judging, and arbitration for financial matters. So if the purpose of mediation is to offer a peaceful, pragmatic, child-centric arena for separating parents to consensually make decisions about how they navigate their way through this transition, who are these mediators and what specifically do they do? Mediators primarily trained to become mediators often with a lot of professional and life experience. And their professional backgrounds are most commonly law, social work, psychology and psychotherapy. Mediators do not give advice, but they need to be knowledgeable about a wide range of subjects, including family law, child development, tax, psychology, research in relation to children in the context of separation and divorce, costs of childcare, costs of mortgages, loan-to-value ratios. I could go on. Mediators do not need to be experts, but they need to have sufficient familiarity so that they can engage in problem-solving discussions, perhaps offering suggestions which expand and reality test the options. Mediators need patience, the ability to empathize and maintain impartiality. They need to be calm, to be able to manage conflict and create a peaceful arena. They need to be practical and non-judgmental, to have a belief that people can find their own solutions. And they need to do this with people across a wide range of social, economic, and cultural backgrounds. So in rephrasing the motion, is mediation fit for purpose, we could ask, is mediation effective? Well, with Professor Liz Trinder here, I'm not going to answer that question, other than say yes in about two-thirds of cases. Most individuals contacting a mediation service do not say, "Are you able to offer a service where I can work closely with my ex-partner in a consensual way to find the best outcome for our children and build on our wish to remain collaborative parents and to make wise and pragmatic decisions about our family finances with integrity, which meet our future needs given our resources?" No. Most parents are highly ambivalent about agreeing to be in the same room as their ex, let alone wanting to hear the other's views about the future arrangements. The motivation is often economic, it's cheaper, it's speed, it's predictability, and that they are in charge of the decision making. And yes, parents do have a sense of wanting to do things in a fair-minded way, and most parents do want to diminish the potential for negative consequences upon their children. What counts in mediation is the mediator's ability to create an arena which re-engages separated parents with their own innate capacity to find solutions, where the competitive arena, so often associated with the adversarial environment, is played down and the cooperative encouraged. I'd like to give a couple of examples of cases that I've mediated. I actually have three, but I'll only go to two for time. First example, I'll call them Anthony and Chloe. So I've chosen these to keep it quite simple. Anthony, Chloe, 30 years old, 4-year relationship, no children. Brief history. Chloe bought a flat in a very expensive part of London 7 years ago for £500,000. She funded that with a £250,000 mortgage, 8 times her salary, wouldn't get it nowadays, and a £250,000 soft loan from her father. She meets Anthony a few years later, and he moves in with her, and they take out a new mortgage in joint names, but the flat remains in Chloe's name. 4 years later, they separate, and Chloe moves out to a friend's flat. They've both taken legal advice. Chloe's advice was that Anthony has no interest in this property. Think of paying the joint mortgage as simply paying rent. Anthony's advice was, "You took out a joint mortgage. No, this is clear intention. This is a joint property. You own half of this property." So they come to see me. Now, as a mediator, I often try and talk about what I call non-problems talk. You know, just if they've got children, it's marvellous. You can talk about their children. It's a very nice way of engaging them. They didn't. So I asked about life generally. I asked, "When did you last meet?" And Chloe said, "Oh, about 2 months ago when I moved out." And she gave me a real gift. She said, "The thing I really miss is the dog." "Oh, right. You have a dog?" "Yeah." "What sort of dog?" "Can't remember." So Anthony, how would it be if Chloe comes around and takes the dog for a walk?" "Fine with me. I'm not stopping her coming around. She can come around any time she wants." "And Chloe, would that be okay? Would you like to go around and take the dog for a walk?" "Yes." So they make an arrangement that Sunday. So that little gift is what mediators are looking for. A little bit of momentum. A little bit of positive momentum. The sense that they can make decisions here. Now the key question to them when we got on to substantive issues was this. To Chloe it was, "Do you think Anthony should receive any money following the sale of the property?" Answer, yes. Answer, question to Anthony. "Do you think Chloe should receive more than 50% of the equity following sale of that?" "Yes." All right. So we've now got a range of a few thousand to a little under 150,000. Now, one can go through the rather sort of vulgar process of inching towards something in the middle as a mediator, but it's, you know, it's just that, it's vulgar, and sometimes you have to do it. But for them, it was really... But for them, the key was to find a formula that spoke to their sense of fairness, which they did have. The formula they came up with was that she had owned the flat for 7 years, divide that by 12 months, 84 months, divide 84 into the equity, which was 300,000, now worth 800, was fine. And you would find out that that flat has gone up by £3,500 each month it's been up. Look at how many months that Anthony contributed, 40. 40 times 1,750, half of 3,500, equals 70,000. And that was their split. Anthony got 70,000, Chloe got 230,000. Now, it's not that far from quarters, you know, quarter, three quarters. But the thing is, they had created it. They owned it. That's the trick in mediation. Second case. Just have a quick. Tim and Kate, I must remember to use these names. Tim and Kate, not the real names. Late 30s, not married, two children, 6 and 8. And Kate has a 12-year-old daughter from a previous relationship. And all five lived in Tim's home in South London. Kate was very worried about the arguments in front of the children, and she felt that their relationship had reached a pivotal point where she really no longer wanted to be in a relationship with Tim, but she couldn't find a way how to extricate herself. And while Tim was visiting his parents in the north of England, what's her name? Kate. Kate moved out with all three children to her flat, which she had a small two-bedroom flat in north London. Tim comes home from his weekend, home empty. Goes to see a solicitor, makes an application for residence order. The solicitor says, look, it might be an idea if you go and see a mediator, because it looks quite good if you've been for a Miami. He comes to me for a Miami, a mediation information assessment meeting. We talk about the possibility of mediation, he agrees to mediate. I meet with Kate, and she's hesitant because she feels a bit bullied by Tim. But she recognises that he's the father of their children, that they've got to make this work, and maybe using the safe environment the mediation offers would be a good way to meet with him again. So she agrees to mediate. So we had a couple of meetings which were quite difficult, and we looked really at interim contact arrangements to try and make some headway on that. But it was really difficult to come up with anything. And Tim felt that his children had been sort of taken away from him. Kate was in the north of London getting their children up at 6:15 in order to catch a tube down, you know, it's just hideous. Now, a key question here was, how would you feel about swapping homes? Tim looked at me, I wasn't too impressed. He had more to give up. I said, would you be willing to consider it hypothetically? Yeah, okay. We considered it. And at the end of that meeting, that's what they did. They agreed a date, 2 weeks then, to swap homes. So Kate comes back to the family home. The children get school easier, back in their own bedrooms. Tim's in North London. He works in the city. That works better. It's got bunk beds so that the children can spend weekends. And we arranged 2 evenings where he would get out of work early and come back to the family home to put the children to bed. And Kate would vacate the home for 2 hours. And we agreed to do it 6 months and then review it. I came back after 6 months and said it was working really well. I said, I think we should carry on doing this. Okay. So I left another 6 months. It was actually 9 months before I saw them. And things had really settled down. And Kate had actually got a full-time job as head of department. She was a teacher. And with that extra mortgage ability, there was then the potential to sell both homes. And they both bought two new homes in South East London near to the children's school. So, really, another example of offering an environment to separated couples who, yes, of course, have their issues, but they also have their responsibilities. And where, I think, very magnanimously, Tim was able to agree to that, and it worked well for them. So to conclude, is mediation fit for purpose? Of course it's fit for purpose. Why wouldn't you want a process of decision-making where you're making all the decisions, where you are making all the decisions about the most personal matters in your life, your home, your children, your money? Why wouldn't you want an environment where you can focus on your children's needs, what is most likely to work best for them? Why wouldn't you want a process that offers a professional decision-making arena with the benefit of legal advice, but where the decision remains yours? Why wouldn't you want a process which encourages integrity, fair-mindedness, and pragmatism? Thank you.
wind up with the big against me.
Oh. Well, of course, I'm an academic, so I can't go anywhere without PowerPoint. We might need some help, though. We do. Oh. Let me tell you about blood. I'm an expert. How's that? It's on the desktop, so. Open. Desktop. Or I could just talk about blood. Right, well, we... Here we go, well... That's a relief. So, I'm speaking on behalf of the GNOME team. I'm very conscious that we have an audience, apart from the very distinguished front row, an audience primarily made up of mediators. So, I'm very conscious of what I'm saying here. I'm talking for the GNOME team. My point, really, though, is that when we're talking about is mediation fit for purpose, the point is not that I'm against mediation. I'm a great fan of mediation. I think it's fantastic, and some of the case examples you've just heard about, you know, just get to the heart of what mediation can achieve. I think the problem is the purpose that mediators or mediation as a process has been given. I think certainly successive governments, and particularly post-Lasco, the purpose that mediation has been given takes it way beyond its capacity. So mediators are expecting to work with a range of clients that really the process wasn't designed to address. So, I'm hoping that I can escape the room quite safely by focusing the problem on the purpose rather than mediation. So, and I'm also talking from a research perspective. So I'm going to focus on three issues in the 10 minutes or so that I've got. So I'll be looking at the issue of compulsion, which has crept into mediation internationally, the issue of risk and safety, and also the issue of effectiveness. So Dominic's already pointed out that mediation is very effective in a high proportion of cases. I'll explore that issue a bit more, effective in relation to what, or in comparison with what. Okay. So the big issue with mediation is what I'm calling self-determination paradox. So Dominic is saying, why wouldn't you choose a process that empowers the clients, that the parties take control of the process, presumably in comparison with an adversarial process? Why wouldn't you want that? And of course, some people do, and many people take that opportunity to engage in a process where they can have some control over the outcome. However, what we've found internationally is that the band of people who do take that opportunity is relatively small. So it's the narrow band really that's between the proportion of people, the great majority of people in most jurisdictions who will actually sort things out for themselves, the 50% or so in most jurisdictions who will sit around the kitchen table. They don't go to mediation, they don't need to, they're mediating themselves. And at the other extreme, you've got people who are approaching or presenting themselves to the court. So there is a relatively narrow band for those people who can't sort themselves out themselves, and those who've already reached their own agreement. So that's the sort of the population that mediators are trying to address, and it is relatively small. As a consequence, in most jurisdictions, there's been ever-increasing attempts to introduce compulsion, so to require parties to consider mediation, in some jurisdictions to actually attempt mediation, to start mediation in good faith. And that's, some mediators will argue that level of compulsion is necessary partly because people just don't know about mediation. There's an information deficit. We need to do much more, obviously, about telling people about the benefits and potential of mediation. But given the limits of communication, perhaps we need to require people to attend a MIAM, for example, so that we can, you know, we have them there in the room and can tell them about the benefits of mediation. I would argue there is some validity in that argument. There is an information deficit. Not that many people know about mediation. But the problem goes beyond that. There's a degree of client resistance as well. Dominic's already said it's a very tough process to go through. So some people are prepared and willing to go for that, but many people aren't. They are unwilling to take this process without the support of a lawyer. It's much more comfortable, much more appropriate process when they're entering it with the support of a lawyer. So research in various jurisdictions highlighting the fact that without compulsion, there's limited uptake of mediation. But even when you do have some elements of compulsion, still there's a level of client resistance that means that mediation uptake is actually relatively small. So for example, in Australia, very, very well-resourced family relationship centres, so $200 million Australian dollars, very high visibility, high street shops, couldn't be more high profile. Even so, in Australia, only a third of the separating population took the opportunity to attend mediation, free mediation, 4 hours free mediation, very well resourced, very highly trained mediation service. So relatively few people took up that opportunity. And it tended to be the worried well. It tended to be the people who probably would have sat round a kitchen table if they didn't have an opportunity, rather than those who were on a course, on the route, on the path towards court. So there's a lot of evidence of client resistance, which means that the level of compulsion is going up all the time, which raises issues about what is this doing to mediation? So we're starting with this idea of self-determination. This is about autonomy, about people creating their own outcomes. What happens to that process when you're requiring people to attend? It may just be for MIAM, or it may be for an actual start to mediation. So the process, I would argue, as we go forward, is becoming somewhat distorted. It's looking less like the mediation we know and love, and possibly more like a court-related process that's less about client autonomy and more about simply seeking settlement. And there's some research that's suggesting that possibly may well have some impact on the satisfaction with mediation of those clients going through the process. And certainly Jan Walker's research from the early 2000s, recent research by Anne Barlow and Rosemary Hunter, suggesting actually the satisfaction with mediation is possibly less than it might have been in the past, so in the low, high 40s. And certainly in comparison with people's satisfaction with lawyers, that's quite a modest figure. So satisfaction with lawyers has always been very, very high, around 60%. So there's this big question about, you know, the more you increase compulsion to require people to attend mediation, the more you're raising questions about client autonomy and what gets to the heart of what mediation process is about. So second point is about risk and safety. We're all very familiar with the very high incidence of safeguarding issues amongst the divorcing separating population, particularly amongst the litigating 10%. So Joan Hunt's very nice research on court populations suggesting around about 50% or so of parties have quite significant safeguarding concerns. I'm talking about children rather than money cases. So we know this population that the government is trying to encourage more towards mediation contains quite high proportions of cases that wouldn't necessarily immediately present themselves as suitable for mediation. So we're already hitting a problem of what are we going to do with these cases where there are significant, at least allegations, that they may well be substantiated. So there's some limited research already from this jurisdiction and Australia and the States about the limitations of the screening process in mediation. We heard earlier my teammate flagging the multiplicity of regulatory bodies within the mediation sector, and this has limited the extent to which we have a coherent screening process. Have to remember as well that mediators don't have the benefit of police and local authority checks that CAFCAS organised for the courts. Those checks are, I would argue, very critical. A study I'm doing at the moment on enforcement, which clearly is at the heavy end of the litigating population, but 37% of those cases, the applicant had safeguarding relevant convictions, at least one conviction, so 37%. So very high figures. And of course, mediators don't have access to that information. So some nice research also by Paulette Morris, who's here today, looking at the very, in some cases, the limited extent to which mediators still screen for domestic violence and other safeguarding issues and the inconsistencies between services. We certainly know from the Australian research, again, that even this very well-resourced, very highly trained, very well-regulated sector in Australia, that a third of cases still are entering mediation with quite significant concerns about safety, including 29% of clients who've been through the mediation process who reported threats and abuse outside of the family relationship centre session. So we've got this possibly toxic mix of very high instances of safeguarding issues, limitations of screening. I'm not saying all mediators don't screen effectively, and I know that some do a very effective job at that, but it's not consistent and it's not consistently rigorous. But we also know that when those cases go proceed through into mediation, that those concerns can be marginalised in practice. Some interesting work, very important work by Dingwall and Great Batch in the early 2000s. How am I doing for time? Oh, I'll give you the salty snacks scenario. Probably not as a compelling story as Dominic's, but one of the cases from our enforcement study, the index order, so the order that the applicant was seeking enforcement of, had originally been based on an agreement that was established in mediation. So the child was two, the parents agreed in mediation for a shared residence order, issues there anyway about, you know, a less than two-year-old having shared time. The agreement stated that the parents would be flexible, that the father wouldn't inflict his smoke on the child, and he wouldn't give the child, the two-year-old, salty snacks. The Schedule 2 report for this shared residence order, and then the enforcement application was triggered by the mother stopping contact because the father was threatening her and threatening the neighbour. The police had installed a panic button, and the Schedule 2 revealed that the father in that case had convictions, I think, 5 for ABH, possession of a bladed weapon, and cruelty towards animals. So all sorts of issues in that case about the effectiveness of screening, which clearly have been, you know, completely awry. It's very difficult to get, I mean, that's an anecdote, you know, that's a single case. It's not a systematic analysis of the effectiveness of screening. We haven't got that data from England and Wales at the moment. The nearest I've got is the Australian example. Again, the family relationship centres, where I've already identified quite significant numbers of cases where concerns have proceeded through intermediation. And from the Australian evaluation, 62% of those who reported concerns said that those concerns and fears had been addressed. But that leaves quite a significant proportion who said that they hadn't. There is a point about, well, you know, if there are safeguarding concerns, then there's still legal aid available to the parties, and the court route is available. Firstly, it's, you know, it's just about domestic violence, but also new research from Rights for Women this week suggesting that there are significant problems for those who are reporting domestic violence to actually access legal aid. So the last point I wanted to look at is the question of effectiveness that Dominic has raised. Mediation can have absolutely fantastic results, and Dominic's you know, given some very good examples of that. The problem is thinking about, well, yes, but compared to what? Is it as effective as other processes? Is it more effective than other processes? Is it, as we keep hearing, the minister, the current minister and his predecessors, you know, better, faster, cheaper? You know, what's the evidence for that? And actually, there's very little evidence for it at all, certainly not anything robust. There's a major issue here with selection effects. So what researchers always talk about was comparing apples and oranges. So it's very difficult to establish effective research or robust research in this area because you're comparing different populations. So people who do mediate are typically have different characteristics to those who go on to litigate. So you would expect mediation to be significantly more positive on a range of indicators simply because they're likely to be easier cases. Because the difficult people with the most difficult problems, you know, try mediation or even bypass mediation and go straight to court. So it's very difficult to establish appropriate comparisons, but what little there is suggests that, you know, there isn't a strong evidence base, certainly in England and Wales, for that better, faster, cheaper. What there is suggests that, you know, there are real benefits compared to other interventions for the easy, you know, essentially the easier cases, so low to mid-range conflict, you know, who are signed up with shiny eyes for mediation, or if you have a relatively expensive specialised intervention such as Bob Emery's work in the States or Jen McIntosh's in Australia. And of course, if you have that level of intervention, then it's not necessarily cheaper than the alternative. So, but the problem is, you know, most research is based on a comparison with contested hearings rather than lawyer negotiations, which is the obvious comparison. So there are two main pieces of research supporting this sort of better, faster, cheaper, and that's a study by the Audit Commission, which is referred to quite frequently by the government. But that faces a significant problem of, you know, comparing like with like. So it's comparing people who attend mediation with those who don't. And the Audit Commission itself recognises that they're not necessarily comparable populations. And the alternative is a very nice study done by Bob Emery in the States, which is a randomised controlled trial. So starting off with populations, randomly assigning them to mediation or the court alternative. The problem with Emery's study, it only included 70 families, so it's a very, very small study. Done a long time ago by a highly charismatic mediator in Virginia. So the government essentially is relying on this study of 70 families, now down to 30 families, to support the more effective message. And that's not to say mediation is not effective, it clearly is. We just don't know if it's better, more effective, or faster or cheaper than other forms of intervention, or what would have happened if another alternative had been used. So, coming back to the start then, what I'm arguing is don't junk mediation, don't necessarily pump huge amounts of money into it, but think about what's its purpose, what is it good for, what's it fit for. So thinking again about the purpose of what are they trying to do? So there are issues about a forced fit, so forcing a mediation process on parties who are not necessarily going to be able to take advantage of its opportunities, and who, by forcing mediation or using so much compulsion, that it's changing the nature of mediation. So lots of these debates are happening elsewhere. So in the States, where they've had mandatory mediation for a long, long time, not just MIAMS, but genuine effort in mediation, they're starting to rethink about, actually, is it right to put people into mediation that we know they're going to fail, and then what are we going to do next? So there's a lot of emphasis now, a lot of thinking about how can we triage, how can we get make an assessment of what does this case need, what does this family need, or what do they think they need, and having very well-designed, well-resourced pathways so that families can head off in the right direction from the start rather than being forced down one route or another. And my argument is that, that if we can make that work, that will enable mediation to really flourish with the right people rather than imposing it on people that it was not designed to address.